Enlightenment understandings of sexuality, for example. And I find that the more de-Islamized or non-Muslim you are, the more Muslim in name you are, the more welcome you are on the left, the more you're open, you're welcome, sorry, into different spaces. So that's what I found. I found that there's a contradiction between what the left says and how it actually approaches and welcomes practicing Muslims within its ranks.
You've said some really interesting stuff there, which I'm going to go into a bit more so shortly, but I want to bring Mirzan in on this. Mirzan, just tell me, what's your experience has been like? You, again, have been involved in left-wing politics here in the UK and have been very active in the past. How was your experience?
I think generally I've been treated okay. You know, my views and my religious beliefs have been widely respected by my friends and comrades within the left. So generally, my experiences have been okay with the organizations that I'm already part of. I am aware that that's not been the case for everyone, but for me, it's been, you know, I've been pretty comfortable. Obviously, internally, there may be discussions that we have had in regards to philosophical views, religious views, but they've always been done in a very comradely manner, not in a very confrontational manner. I felt as though my views have been respected, even though, you know, people who are within the same organization might have opposing views. But at the same time, it depends on what you're standing on. If it goes against our religious beliefs, our philosophical and moral beliefs, then obviously we cannot stand in those platforms, make those kind of alliances. But if it is something that doesn't go against what we believe in and something that may be for what we believe in, then I think from my experiences, I've been very welcomed in those spaces. So, you know, I haven't seen an issue with that at the moment.
Thank you. It's very insightful what you've mentioned there. I want to come back to you, Omar, because what you said earlier was really interesting. You have raised the question about whether or not some Muslims are actually even welcome in left-wing politics, particularly conservative, traditionalist, practicing Muslims, basically. Now, I want to explore that a bit more because I know many Muslims, and some of the things they would tell me is that, you know, we get the left on things like anti-war, anti-racism. Of course, they get it as a minority here. They would, especially with the West engaged in wars in Muslim countries and stuff like that. But Islam is actually socially quite conservative in many aspects. So they might even see eye to eye with conservative political parties here in the UK when it comes to things like, I don't know, support for a marriage setup, being critical of abortions, being critical of, liberal thinking on a lot of social issues. So just tell me what you think on that, because is that the real issue here? The fact that Muslims are socially conservative based on their religious beliefs, but okay, on some issues they can coincide with the left on, say, anti-imperialism and politics, that type of thing.
Well, I think there is certainly, you know, Islam is a, you know, as you say, is a socially conservative religion in many ways. It differs from the left in its understanding. And I think one thing that's very clear is that the left, as well as being unwelcoming of practicums, the reason why it does that, I think, is because in many respects it fails to, one, understand where Islam comes from theologically on some of these issues, such as sexuality, for example. You know, when it comes to LGBT campaigning, that's very much based in their understanding of putting people in different identities and essentially saying that you belong to this identity or that identity. Well, Islam doesn't really have that understanding. Islam thinks about these things in terms of deeds and practices. It doesn't put someone in a tick box identity area because they do one thing or the other. So one is a lack of understanding. I also think that there is, just in general, a lack of strategic thinking and also a lack of genuine support for freedom of expression. You know, we think about the left as supporting these kind of things, but actually it doesn't think about how it wants to build a coalition to take power, to take authority. It doesn't understand in a way that I think some other parts of the left, because I wouldn't put all the left in the same category. If we look at Mick Lynch, who is the General Secretary of the RMT Union, the Rail Workers Union, he's said that actually we need to be understanding about people who are church-going or mosque-going, and they may run up with problems with people on the left, but we have to understand where they're coming from, respect their beliefs, and try to build a broad coalition. I think many people on the left, on the Western left, have a very intolerant position. They don't seem to understand the need to build coalitions. And I think there are going to be cases, and probably already have been, where they're going to, because they're so extreme on pushing their particular views on these social issues, pushing people who are their natural political allies in so many other areas into the hands of the far right, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that the left needs to really tackle and consider.
Now, Mirzan, let me bring you back in on this. Let me just ask you straight up. Now, I've been associated with some left-wing activism in the past myself. I know very well what you're likely to encounter when dealing with the left. We're talking about things like atheists, staunch atheists. We're talking about people who are against all religion. We're talking about feminism, things, ideologies that might see like the hijab, the niqab, as being blatantly oppressive, and even critics of Islam. You may encounter on the left. So just tell me, how can you justify, as a religious Muslim, engaging and working alongside individuals who may have this type of mindset?
I think where our main issue lies is issues to do with LGBTQ and trans and trans rights and all those kind of things. For me, my experience has been is that there are avenues within the left that are open to debate, that there are spaces within the left where you can talk about gender ideology or gender critical kind of, you know, ideas, debate them, contest them. I've always seen the left as a market and as a place of contestation. And I've had my views known about the trans issues. And my views is that we don't agree with kind of vigilante violence, or I don't agree with physical harm or oppression. But at the same time, I won't agree with lifestyles and people's form of behaviour that go against my religious and philosophical beliefs. And I think from where I stand, as long as I've made myself clear where my red lines are, I've been pretty much welcomed and tolerated by some individuals, let's just say.
Well, they have it, Amar. Let me come back on. I want to ask you a very similar question because, you know, I'm a little bit tired of the left. I think I've reached a stage now where I'm kind of over it. Jeremy Corbyn era has gone. He was very popular with Muslims here in the UK. And I think we look at the wider left-wing world. Any Muslim politician I see who succeeds in left politics, one thing we notice from them that they have in common is that they have clearly been criticised for compromising on their Islamic traditions, on their upbringing, basically. Ilhan Omar, who have we got here? We've got the Muslim London mayor, Sadiq Khan. Hamza Yousaf is even being questioned right now whether he's left the fold of Islam because of his defence of same-gender relationships on camera to journalists. So just tell me, quite frankly, do you think that we actually can, as Muslims, really identify, say, socialists or lefties? Surely there's a big issue here.
Well, I mean, I personally do consider myself to be of the left. I would call myself a socialist. But I think that one has to be very, as a practicing Muslim, be very clear-eyed about these things. One, I think you have to understand the context within which you live, and the context, particularly being in the West, I think is different to being in a leftist in other spaces. You know, we have to understand that in large part, not all of them, but in large part, people who are, let's say, militant atheists or evangelical atheists, their ultimate aim is to acculturate us out of Islam and our belief system. Some of the old school type, the very extreme ones, might even view us as some sort of unreconstructed savages, right? But we have to understand that that is their position. There are some issues with which we can work with them, other issues in which we understand, actually, we don't agree with you on that. And I think we just have to, be more confident. You know, after two decades of securitization and ideological warfare, intergenerational ideological warfare, particularly mm-hmm. targeted at young people, we have to try to recapture an understanding that actually we do have a stake in our societies, and we, you know, if we put ourselves forward strongly and we defend our positions, unlike people like Sadiq Khan or Hamza Yousaf or whatever. I wouldn't say that, you know, the only reason they've reached that position is because they've compromised on their views. They didn't try to... I wouldn't say they tried in the first place to really defend their views. So we don't know what the alternative outcome would have been.
Fair enough.
People like Hamza Yousaf are very influential. Sadiq Khan, you know, I think they could have tried. They didn't try. So that, I think, is the first step. We need to understand that actually we have a stake. Let's defend our positions. And okay, some people probably will be filtered out of the process. But the only way you move the needle forward is if everyone contributes to that effort. The business of politics is the business of normalizing beliefs.
But with that's what we have to do. With that way of thinking, surely that means that, well, for example, we could work toe-to-toe with some right-wing thinkers because they have conservative views. I don't know, like Tommy Robinson, for example, a notorious Islamophobe, has recently said things which perhaps Muslims might agree with. He's a notorious Islamophobe, for anyone who doesn't know. But, I mean, that way of thinking, okay, let's work with the left. We know they don't like us on these issues, but let's work with them. Well, that could be applied to anyone. Why is it that we're working with the left and we're not working with the far right even?
Well,
they're conservative.
Well, I would say that actually we should be broader in terms of who we're working. That should include people on the right. I wouldn't include people like Tommy Robinson or Stephen Yaxley-Lennon is his actual name, of course, who, as you say, is a notorious Islamophobe, is a fascist. We shouldn't be working with those sorts of people. But I think we should be trying to work now in this junction, which the left actually is quite irrelevant in Britain. It's been smashed. It's irrelevant in many parts of Europe and the rest of the Western world. We should be having strategic political alliances with people across the political spectrum. I've got no problem with that. And I think, actually, you touch on something very important, is that where we share commonalities, we should try to work with people. The important thing is, as a Muslim who's engaged in that political work, you just have to be very confident in your own belief system, and you have to be assertive in what you believe. And if they don't want to accept that, well, that's their problem.
Mizan, let me bring you back in. Now, again, I want to ask you, because you know the left very well from past work that you've done. Just tell me, do you not feel as if there may be a case, examples that you've seen, of Muslims who are leaning more to left-wing politics and actually leaning away from Islam? I mean, for example, I worry that there may be sisters, for example, who are very politically active. They get caught up in socialist ideas and socialist thinkers, and they are moving away from concepts like they'll be anti-hijab, for example, but they'll be very pro-socialism, for example. And obviously the priority should be hijab here. So just tell me, have you ever seen this example? Is it something that you're concerned about at all?
I'm not sure if I can say if I've seen a large percentage or a growing percentage of Muslims leaning towards communism or atheism more. There are people from within our background who would identify themselves as communists or even atheists, but I can't comment on their religious practice prior to them joining these groups because I frankly didn't know them back then. But what I can say is, firstly, like communism and these kind of ideas, they're not just, you know, they're not just part of the Western world. A lot of them, there are Arab communists, you know, Arab atheists as well, Middle Eastern atheists as well, people from what we would call part and part of the Muslim world who have these ideas. I think if you have a strong religious foundation, a strong religious upbringing, if you are grounded in your religion and engaged in your religion, I think you will have a strong basis to at least theologically and philosophically counter those arguments while standing in solidarity with said groups on issues that we all agree with.
Amar, let me come back to you because one thing which, again, I notice is that Islam has everything for us. As Muslims, we get everything from Islam. We don't need any other ideology, surely. I mean, there's this case of a popular trend of Muslims praising left-wing anti-imperialist heroes like Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. Now, I'm not saying that they don't deserve praise. Obviously, they did a good thing for their nations, for their people, for their movements. But, I mean, Islam, we have our own heroes. We don't need to aspire to be the next Fidel Castro. We've got our own bearded heroes, surely, that we should aspire to promote, to talk about, to try and live up to their example.
Well, I agree with that. And I think that part of the problem is that there are, in the 20th and 21st century, very few examples of successful Islamic resistance movements sort of pushing forward and taking state authority and even just, you know, being able to be influential in different states. There are some of them, of course, as we know. But for the most part, I suppose people tend to praise people like Fidel Castro and, you know, people like that because they have, you know, they're very recent examples of successful anti-imperialist action. And actually, I don't think that's necessarily a problem, because if the extent of that is joining a coalition that is trying to tackle two of the greatest threats and problems for Muslims geopolitically in the world today, which is the United States of America and the State of Israel, then I think we should be allied in that. In fact, if you look at someone like Hugo Chavez, he was completely counter to some of these militant atheists. He was a, you know, practicing Catholic himself. He was a very strong ally of Iran. He used to talk about Imam Mehdi. He used to understand that Islam is actually, you know, politically very anti-imperialist and an ally. So, you know, we don't have greats like Hugo Chavez with us today on the planet, but, you know, there are examples of actually different anti-imperialist leaders across the world coming together, understanding the importance of religion in liberation. You know, some people call that liberation theology. That's got a particular trend in certain countries in Latin America. And I don't see a problem with that. Obviously, Islam is comprehensive, but it doesn't mean that we can't look to inspiring and successful movements that have managed to do things that are not necessarily contradictory or incompatible with Islam.
For sure. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. There's so much more we could have discussed, but unfortunately we are running out of time. So I'll have to say thank you to you, Amar, and thank you to Mizan as well for joining us. And thank you to everyone at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam, inshallah. But for now, salamu alaikum.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the physical and spiritual adornment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the physical and spiritual adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic lifestyle, obviously, when we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to adorn ourselves physically and spiritually. Now, when we talk about the physical adornment, there are specific things which are very much emphasized in the Islamic teachings. Number one is to be in the state of wudu, or having a ghusl, bath. And you know that there are different types of bathing. For example, the ghusl of the day of Jum'ah. There are other ghusl in order to keep ourselves clean. And one of the conditions of entering the prayer or performing the daily prayers is to be in the state of purification, in the state where we wash our hands, our mouth. What does it mean? It means like we are cleaning ourselves. We are adorning ourselves. We try to beautify ourselves. On the other hand, it is said that a mu'min or believer must have the clean clothes on him with the light colors like the white color or the green color. So these are the colors that we need to use in clothing, the light color clothing and not the dark ones. And then after that, what we see is to use perfume, to put on a good perfume. It is also recommended in the Islamic teachings when it talks about the physical appearance, physical adornment, and also to use a mirror. Now, having a mirror with myself, carrying a mirror and keeping myself clean and neat and clean, it is necessary in the Islamic teachings. And that's what we see, that in different narrations, these are the things that are the most we can say, emphasized in the Islamic teachings. Therefore, it is necessary to have these things in our life and to teach this to our kids so that when they are raised, inshallah, we raise them with the physical adornment. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the physical and spiritual adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. For the physical adornment, we gave some examples that is being emphasized in the Islamic teachings. But on the other hand, when we talk about adornment, when we talk about titivation, Islam gives importance to the spiritual adornment as well. The spiritual adornment is that we need to have a good manners. We must deal with people with good manners. We must be having a good ethics, inshallah. And whereas we have the good appearance, on the other hand, we should have the good spirituality as well. And it is said by Imam Ali alayhi salam, Al-Jamalu Zahiru Husnu Surah, that the beauty of the apparent beauty is that you look good, you are having good clothes, your hairs are combed, you look good, you have a good appearance. And that is the zahir, that is the apparent. Wal jamalul batil, and the spiritual beauty is that husnu sarira, that we have a good sira. Sira is a lifestyle, that when we talk to people, we talk in a good way. When we give advice to the people, we give the best advice. We do not backbite people. We do not lie. We do not show jealousy to the people for what we do not have. So therefore, it is necessary to have the purification of the hearts in order to have the spiritual adornment. And this spiritual adornment comes with the purification. The more purified the someone is, the more adorned, he has adorned himself spiritually more if he has this purification, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Nakba is not merely a past event. It is an ongoing reality Palestinians live, where every day brings more killings, closures, detentions, home demolitions, racial discrimination, humiliation, and segregation by the Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "In the Palestinian memory, the month of May will always be associated with the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the native Palestinian population from their homes and lands in 1947-49 was foundational to the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel. It was only with the forced expulsion of 750,000 to 1 million Palestinians, as well as the killing of thousands of others, many in tens of masses across Palestine, that the emerging Zionist regime could secure a Jewish majority. But clearly, the colonial regime is not yet feeling either satisfied or safe. On the contrary, this month, May 2023, 75 years after the Nakba, Palestine has endured a series of new Israeli regime assaults. On May 2nd, the Palestinian prisoner Khaz Adnan died in an Israeli regime jail after nearly 3 months of hunger strike. He embarked on hunger strike in protest at his administrative detention. Detention without charge or trial. Adnan spent 8 years on and off in Israeli regime prison, mostly in administrative detention. His death could not have been an accident. The Zionist regime was aware that he needed urgent health care, yet none was proffered and was not transferred to hospital. He was allowed to die on purpose in order to deter other prisoners from engaging in similar hunger strikes. His death triggered a major Israeli regime assault, which started on May 9th, when Israeli regime warplanes struck a number of residential buildings in Gaza where families were sleeping. The first strikes killed 12 and injured 20. Among the victims were three Islamic Jihad fighters, along with their wives and children. That first assault was followed by several others over 5 days. At least 33 Palestinians were killed, the majority civilians, including 7 children. The fabricated regime of Israel has killed some 140 Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza since the beginning of 2023. Since the 1948 Nakba, the Zionist regime has killed over 100,000 Palestinians and destroyed at least 130,000 homes and other structures. Since the occupation of the rest of historic Palestine in 1967, the Zionist regime has imprisoned more than 1 million Palestinians, while still depriving Palestinian refugees from returning to their homes and villages. And in recent years, May has become the killing month. In 2021, an Israeli regime assault on Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque led to a broad confrontation with Palestinians across Palestine, resulting in the killing of 256 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children and 40 women. Last May, an Israeli sniper killed renowned Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghle while she was working in Jenin. A few days later, Israeli regime police attacked her funeral in Al-Quds. Such wanton violence suggests that the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing project has not finished. A regime based on aggression and the systematic terrorizing of Palestine's native population will not rest easy until the project started in 1948 is complete. But in 75 years, the Zionist regime has not yet succeeded to back up its foundational lie that Palestine was a land with no people. By obliterating the Palestinian people, their memory, their history, or their refusal to give up. In other words, the Zionist regime is fearful and agitated. It lives in constant obsession with being surrounded by danger. In light of such logic, the existence of Palestinians in Palestine alone is incendiary to the colonial regime of Israel. After the latest Israeli regime aggression on Gaza, which saw at least six Islamic Jihad leaders assassinated, the Zionist regime projected arrogance. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's prime minister, declared that Israel's assault had changed the balance of deterrence and proudly announced that Israel's flag march and annual right-wing nationalist assertion of sovereignty over occupied Al-Quds would proceed as planned. Stable and sane countries do not feel the need to prove sovereignty over cities they claim as capitals. It is a symbol of deep-seated malaise that the Zionist regime considers it a glorious victory after 56 years of occupation to organize a march for settlers to wave flags in Al-Quds. The flag march is a victory only in the way the Israeli regime's military ability to kill and detain Palestinians or encage them in checkpoints is a victory. It is made possible only through overwhelming force and the continued support of Western regimes. The hollow victory is not a defeat for Palestinians who continue to struggle and resist to preserve their existence despite the tremendous suffering and military violence they have to confront. The Zionist regime cannot give up its inherently violent colonial nature precisely because it was established by uprooting a people from their homeland. The continued presence of Palestinians on part of their land directly contradicts the Zionist narrative of how the fabricated regime of Israel emerged. The fabricated regime of Israel is still in denial and believes the only way for it to continue to exist is through the ethnic cleansing and cancellation of Palestine's indigenous people. Every new Israeli crime maximizes Palestinian suffering, but it also demonstrates that far from being confident and at ease with itself, the Zionist regime is a regime of fear and insecurity. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported recently the Israeli occupation authorities demolished, confiscated, or forced people to demolish 42 structures in East Al-Quds and Area C of the West Bank, including 17 homes, citing the lack of Israeli-issued building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain, displacing 50 Palestinians, including 23 children, and affecting the livelihoods of more than 600 others, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory. It said in its bi-weekly protection of civilians report covering the first 2 weeks of May, that 9 of the structures were provided by donors as humanitarian assistance, including a school. More than half of the affected structures were in Area C, which is under full Israeli regime military control, including a donor-funded school. The remaining 16 structures were demolished in occupied East Al-Quds, including 2 residential structures demolished in Wadi Qaddoum area of Selwan, resulting in the displacement of 7 households comprising 39 people, including 22 children. Another 7 structures were destroyed by their owners to avoid the payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. Additionally, in Area A of the West Bank, under full Palestinian rule, Israeli regime forces destroyed 1 residential structure and caused damage to 3 others during an Israeli regime operation carried out in the old city of Nablus. On May 7th, Israeli regime forces demolished an EU-funded Palestinian school serving at least 40 pupils from Jeb al-Deeb near Beit Lahm, citing the lack of an Israeli-issued building permit and structural safety concerns. 57 schools across the West Bank are at risk of demolition, said OCHA. In a separate incident, on May 10th, the Israeli Civil Administration, along with Israeli regime forces, dismantled and confiscated 2 tents that were used as temporary classrooms for the pupils of the school of Jeb al-Deeb. The tents were provided as humanitarian assistance in response to the demolition on May 7th. During the confiscation, confrontations erupted between Palestinian residents and the Zionist regime forces. As a result, 8 Palestinians were injured. School equipment, including chairs and desks, were confiscated by Israeli regime forces. On May 2nd and 3rd, Israeli regime forces raided the villages of Hajja in Ghal Ghilya Governorate and Haris in Salfit Governorate in Area B of the West Bank, which is under Palestinian administration and the Zionist regime military control, and demolished on punitive grounds 2 multiple-story homes of families. 3 households comprising 14 people, including 8 children, were displaced. 9 others, including 3 children, were otherwise affected. Since the beginning of 2023, 10 homes and 1 agricultural-related structure have been demolished by the Zionist regime forces on punitive grounds, compared with 14 structures in all of 2022 and 3 in 2021. Punitive demolitions are a form of collective punishment and as such are illegal under international law as they target the families of a perpetrator or alleged perpetrator, said OCHA. In addition to the demolitions, the OCHA report said that from the beginning of 2023 until May 15th, the Zionist regime forces killed 108 Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, more than double the death toll of 51 in the same period in 2022. And 12 other Palestinians have been shot and killed by Israeli regime forces while attacking or trying to attack forces in the West Bank.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer the questions you have regarding the upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Because of you, I laugh a little harder. I cry a little less and I smile a lot more. Well, that's what I have a feeling towards my friends. And when we have such feelings towards our friends, we have responsibilities towards them. And today in our episode, we're going to talk about responsibilities towards friends. And Professor Salman Nakavi is going to help us. Professor, talking about responsibilities and making our children responsible towards so many things, friendship is a very important bond in our lives. Do we have responsibilities towards our friends?
Yes, we need to understand that, number one, it's important for us, for our children, to have friends of their same age, the peers who can they can have a bonding with them, and which is beneficial to all of them. They need to have friends whom they can confide in. They need to have friends whom they can be a little feel free with them in discussing things and ideas which are important for them. So it is very important. You can't deny this. You can't say that let my child grow up without having friends. He should be in solitary confinement as far as reaching out and bonding with others is concerned. You cannot stop him from doing so, and you should not stop him from doing so, especially nowadays. A lot of parents are thinking about homeschooling. They want their children to study at home. So one of the downsides of this thing is that friendships develop in schools. Yes, the problem today is that we have difficulties in finding good friends for our children. We need to help them and assist them in developing bonds of friendship with the appropriate people.
Yeah.
We need to be concerned with the fact that, not with the fact that they're making friends, but we need to be concerned with the fact that what type of friends they are interacting with.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to teach them and to make a responsible decision, a conscious decision about what friends they need to adopt and what type of friends they need to remain aloof of.
Yeah.
So there are many things that one should find in a friend. One should be trustworthy of a person who is truthful, who is sincere, who is in his behavior of a behavior which is not abusive, now not letting one down by abusing him or criticizing him or whatever. So we need people to interact with positive friends. So we need to help set some guidelines to our children, for our children to look for what in their friends. You need to set guidelines and say to your child that, look, Number one, you need to find a friend who can help you improve yourself.
Exactly.
Whether it's in your studies, a friend who can help you in your studies. You can work together and become better in your studies.
Yeah.
Or in your conduct and behavior, in becoming good human beings,
yeah.
In becoming good Muslims. Find friends whom you can pray together with. Go out together to attend majalis and gatherings which are important as religious human beings.
Yeah. So we'll discuss more things with you after a short break. Dear listener, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Akavi, and we are talking about our responsibility towards our friends. While talking about friends, your friends make you actually choose the path towards the prosperity or towards success again or towards
towards disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a relationship with friends who take you into a destructive relationship. You carry out things which are not allowed, which are not permitted in society or according to our religious principles and values. They engage in activities which, if you, under peer pressure, start doing them those things, then you will also be relegated to a very small status. So you need to make your child understand, look, you need to manage and you need to develop a group of friends who you can depend upon and rely upon to perfect yourself. And you should be in such a way that if somebody evaluates your group, he gives you high grades for that.
Yeah.
That look, what a beautiful and cohesive group there is, who is working for the betterment of their own betterment.
Yeah.
And they're working for the betterment of the society.
Yeah.
I mean, so even at school age, even at high school age, even at college age, the friends can get together to carry out so many activities which are for the society, for the betterment of society, for improving the society,
yeah.
Instead of making it a worse place to live in.
Yeah.
As a group of friends can bring about so many changes in their surroundings, in their neighborhood, in their school, in their college. They can become examples and role models of a group activity for many others.
Yeah.
So we need to bring this home to our child, that you are responsible for developing good, positive relationships with other children whom you can work with, especially of your own age. And you can, you need a person, you need to be working in a group, as a team, to work, whether at studies.
Yeah.
Somebody is good in something, in some subject, the other is good in another subject, they help each other to overcome their problems and overcome their deficiencies and those things which they lack in. Or they can also become a good team in helping others out also, outside their group.
Yeah. So what is important is that it should be both ways. Like, I should not be expecting my particular friend should be having these particular qualities. He should be taking me towards the prosperity. I should also be myself feeling responsible. Whosoever I am friends with, I should be guiding them towards the right path. Well, we can discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Nakavi and we are discussing what are our responsibilities towards our parents and how do we teach that to our children? Well, Professor, there is a very beautiful verse in Surah Furqan, probably it's the verse number 28, that says, "Woe to me, I wish I had not taken that particular person as my khalil, as my friend." This verse teaches us a lot in itself, like your friends can actually determine the way of your prosperity and again, the way of your disaster. So we got to be very careful in choosing friends. And you had been discussing that we also, when we make friends, we have to be responsible that we don't show them some disastrous path. It's our responsibility to be leading them towards prosperity. What are your more comments on that?
Yes, we have in the holy verse of the Quran, in the Surah Fatwa, where it talks about Muhammad Rasulullah, وَالَّذِينَ مَعَهُ أَشَدَّاءُ عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ. So basically the Ummah of Islam, of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they are friends, they are bonded together in bonds of mercy and love to each other. So we need to develop a society which is based on this bonding. And the bonding is based on the faith. إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَةٌ. All faithful people, all believers are bonded in a bond of brotherhood.
Yeah.
So this brotherhood has to be developed in forms of small groups which work together. So this has to be learned from the beginning of, from a very early age. In early life, we need to be able to develop bonding with people who are going to become our friends, whom we are going to be identified with, and whom even in the day of the hereafter, the day of judgment, we will be also judged based on what types of friends we have been making. So, is making friends and bonding and having these relationships, they are very important in the development of human society and in the development of an individual, as an individual, a person who wants to excel and perfect himself in the spiritual sense and elevate himself to the proximity of Allah Almighty. These friendships have to be developed in a positive way. So we need to teach our children ourselves, we need to become examples and role models for our children in how we bond with our others.
Yeah.
And how we deal with them and how we make friends. And secondly, give them guidelines that this is what you should be looking in a friend. A friend who is faithful, who is reliable, who is truthful, who is sincere, who is ready to sacrifice his time, his money for you and for that group. And you are ready to do the same for him. وَتَوَاسَوْ بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاسَوْ بِالصَّبْرِ. This is important for faithful and believing people, human beings. And تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى. And وَلَا تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْإِسْمِ وَالْعُدْوَانِ. So we should be working together and cooperating and collaborating to carry out things which are based on taqwa.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Professor. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you for guiding us with so beautiful tips. Thank you so much to our listeners who are listening to IRIB English Radio. And if you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab, COI, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs over there. You can also listen to our small clips on the social media platforms by typing Call of Islam. Thanks so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
The This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.